You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 99. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about the Bolivar Archaeological Project. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today, we have Dr. Maria Franklin, Doug Boyd, and Dr. Alex Menaker on the show, and they are going to introduce themselves. Dr. Franklin, would you want to start?
Yep, Maria Franklin. I'm an archaeologist, and I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin.
Perfect. Doug?
My name is Doug Boyd, and I'm a senior archaeologist at Stantec Incorporated, and I'm, along with Alex, a co-principal investigator on the Bolivar Archaeological Project.
I was going to say, I guess that only leaves you.
I'm Alex Menaker. I am a senior archaeologist with Stantec Consulting, and I am also, as I mentioned, the co-principal investigator of the Bolivar Archaeological Project.
So this, first of all, welcome. Excited to talk to you all more today. And this is a two-part episode. So we actually already, we recorded it a little bit in reverse. We recorded the second part first. So this is the first part. So if everyone stays tuned for next month, there will be a follow-up episode to this episode that I promise, since we've already done it, you won't want to miss. And this episode, though, is the context for that episode. And so why don't we get started? Let's go back before the Bolivar Project and start with a previous project that it sounds led to this one. So let's start by talking about the Ransom Williams Farmstead Project.
Okay. That was a, like the Bolivar Project, the Ransom Williams was a TxDOT road project. And for that one, we were doing the data recovery excavations on an African-American farmstead that was being impacted by a toll road construction in South Travis County near Austin, Texas. And that work started for us back in about 2007. We did the data recovery investigations about 2009. And then for the next few years, we were analyzing and writing reports. And they were published in 2012 and 2015. And for that, a big component of it, besides the archaeology and the archival research, a big component was the community outreach and oral history project. And fortunately, I knew I was in over my head, and I made a phone call to Maria Franklin. We met for breakfast and talked about the project, and fortunately, she said she was interested, and that was the best decision I ever made. And that really community outreach part of that project is what made the project so rich and rewarding, not only for us, but for the descendant community. And I'll let Maria speak to the oral history component on that a little bit. But that's in a nutshell what happened. And so when the Bolivar Project came up, TxDOT came to us specifically to have us recreate the model that we used for the Ransom Williams Project.
I think Doug pretty much summed it up pretty well. Part of the community outreach involved doing with descendants, including lineal descendants of Ransom and Sarah Williams, who lived at the farmstead. It took 2 years for our project historian to locate the descendants who were living in East Austin at the time, but we did oral histories with them, but we also did oral histories with African Americans who grew up in the vicinity of the farmstead and in Antioch Colony, about 5 miles from the Williams farmstead site. And through that oral history project, that really evolved into a way in which to collaborate more closely with the descendant community authority in writing a narrative about the past that was related to the history of the Williams farmstead, but to Black Texas rural agrarian life more generally as well. So it was a really rewarding project. And I think because of it, TxDOT thought that this would be a good fit or a good way to proceed with the Bolivar Archaeological Project. The two are related.
Yeah. And I will say, as a CRM cultural anthropologist, I always think it's a good idea to bring in a CRM cultural anthropologist for projects. So I support your decision, Doug.
Thank you.
And okay.
Just for the audience, the Ransom Williams Project, a lot of the information is available on that on a website called Texas Beyond History. It's easy to find the Williams Project on that. And you can actually even download the oral history reports and the archaeology reports from that website.
So Texas DOT, which is, for anyone that doesn't know, the Texas Department of Transportation, they reached out about the Bolivar site, which it's only taken me two episodes to get. They reached out. And what were they reaching out about? What kind of project was this?
So the site was actually recorded. Two sites that we did excavations on, data recovery work, and one was called the Flirton Hotel and one was the Tom Cook Blacksmith Shop. Those sites were recorded in 2016 and 2019, and along with others on the survey for this road project. And then we were brought in beginning in about 2020 and came in and did the archaeological field work and started the oral history and community outreach and started our more intensive archival research. So at the point we went into the field, we knew Tom Cook was an African-American freedman and that the site was likely his blacksmith shop. Another firm had done enough archaeological work there to reveal that. And so we started with that and did very intensive investigations over the whole impact area. Most of it now, the road work is virtually complete and it's pretty much gone. So this was typical of a lot of the TxDOT salvage projects where we have an opportunity to go out and find everything and learn what we can before the road is built. And so that's how we got involved in this particular project.
Yeah. So on the archaeology side, and again, this is where you're going to tell that I'm a cultural anthropologist, not an archaeologist, but was it a complete excavation? Were you just doing a portion of the site? What was the methodology there?
Yeah, to show, so there's survey, which is phase one, to identify presence, absence of sites. And then there was the phase two previously done, which was just testing to identify and do more extensive excavations of a site once it's identified. And then there's phase three, which is comprehensive data recovery excavations. And that's what our team was brought in to do. And so recognizing the significance of these historical sites of Tom Cook's Blacksmith Shop as an African-American freedman, and as well as then the Sarton Hotel across the street associated with the Chisholm Trail, we were brought in to then excavate the entire artifact, remains, assemblages, because the road is going to just cover it all. And so these were significant enough sites that then it was recommended to excavate and document comprehensively the entire remains. So this is a phase three data recovery. So we excavated the entire thing. And then, as we mentioned, we threw the whole kitchen sink at it, learning disciplinary boundaries, working with anthropologists and oral history programs, and bringing in descendant community members to register a much richer history that broadens the narrative history.
So right before we move on to the community outreach and the oral history, I do want to highlight one thing that you said there. And can you tell us a little bit about was it Chisholm Trail? Is that how you say it?
Yes. And so with TxDOT, we have to create an archaeological research design that looks at our focus on what we're going to be investigating. And so that was centered around the fact that the Sarton Hotel and the Tom Cook Blacksmith Shop are both commercial businesses in a small rural frontier town. And so that was our guiding principle for organizing it. But historically, they were associated with the Chisholm Trail. And the Chisholm Trail began in 1867 and was used as a major cattle trail for driving herds of cattle from South Texas up through North Texas, through the town of Bolivar, right adjacent to Bolivar, and up through the Oklahoma Territory, all the way up to Kansas. In central Kansas, there were railheads where they would put the cattle on rail cars and ship them back east. So the Chisholm Trail was an economic boom in Texas. It was a big deal. They estimate that between 1867 and 1886, 5 to 6 million cattle were driven up the Chisholm Trail because you could sell the cattle for a lot more money if you went through that process. And it's the stuff of legend. How many Hollywood movies have you seen about driving cattle across? And a lot of that's related to the Chisholm Trail.
And also, when we think of the Chisholm Trail or any sort of cattle trail like this, it could be wide swaths of almost a mile of width of massive amounts of cattle moving. So it's not just necessarily like a narrow stretch. And people would follow the trail and sort of the ruts and navigate certain crossings. But it was just a wide swath of it. And Bolivar was right along the way there. And Tom Cook was an essential figure facilitating that journey.
And the Chisholm Trail was not named for John Chisholm. A lot of people make that mistake. It was named for a man named Jesse Chisholm, who I believe was part Native American and who had trading posts in the Indian Territory. And he was the first one who established the trail through the Indian Territory, and the name Chisholm Trail got applied to the entire route.
Okay. So what was the time period, just so they know, like overlap of the site itself compared to the Chisholm Trail?
Excellent. So we know Tom Cook is at this location as a blacksmith in Bolivar by 1872, maybe 1871, perhaps even a year or two earlier. And we know that he is there for the rest of his life, and he ended up passing away in 1898. So he is the most documented Bolivar blacksmith. There were other blacksmiths who we know show up in the records, but Tom Cook is the one who was there consistently, is recalled by people writing about Bolivar history many years later, and consistently shows up in the records as the Bolivar blacksmith.
Okay, so the archaeology at this point has shown that it was Mr. Tom Cook. So from there, how did you approach, Maria, how did you approach the community outreach and the oral history component to learn more about who Mr. Tom Cook was?
Okay, that's a really good question. Because when I was called in to consult on the project, it was specifically to work locally with descendants who would be associated with the Tom Cook blacksmith shop. So these would be, of course, very likely African Americans. TxDOT already has a very big public outreach program called Beyond the Road, and so they really handle the regional, statewide interface with the public, and I worked locally. So because I'm not from Denton, but Doug had done research up there before, he suggested that I reach out to Kim Cupid, who is a curator with the Denton Art History and Culture, and he said she might know someone who's related to the Cooks or who to do outreach with, because Bolivar, I understand, it's still Bolivar, but it's a very small rural town. There's not like a big black population. There's not a local black population there. So I just started cold calling people, which is I called up black churches in the area, historical societies, the Denton County Genealogical Society, the NAACP. I'm just calling up everybody. But I also reached out to Kim Cupid and said, because Denton, the city of Denton, is the closest city, Bolivar. And I said, there's a connection there. And I get on the phone with Kim Cupid, and she had already been emailing with us. And she's, I think I know the lineal descendants of Tom Cook. She said, here's the number for Miss Betty Kimball. She's a docent with our African American Museum. I got on the phone and called her up, and sure enough, she remembered Kitty Cook, her grandmother, but did not know much about her great-grandfather, Tom Cook. And she did know her family was from Bolivar, so there was some knowledge that, yes, that's where they started before they made it into the city of Denton. So from there, I met Howard Clark, her nephew, and his daughter, Haley Wright. We brought Haley Wright and Howard Clark onto the project team as descendant community liaisons. So they were part of the paid staff employed by Stantec for the project. And it was important to me that we got them on board before the excavation started. So I was hired in September, and within 3 to 4 weeks easily, if not sooner, we had Clark and Wright on board as part of the project team.
Oh.
I wanted to make sure that there was consultation with descendants on every aspect of the project as much as was possible. which is very hard because they dictate the schedule to get excavated and so on and so forth. So there was, we were circumscribed to a large extent by that and by TxDOT's needs and so forth. But Howard Clark ended up working on the site as a field tech, learning archaeology. He was there day in, day out. My idea was to get them involved and also have them help to identify other Black stakeholders who would also be interested in the project. And so that's what we did. It was during the pandemic, so we met via Zoom, those initial meetings, but we met pretty regularly. Talked about, what is this project? What are your roles? What kinds of roles? What kinds of expectations do you have? Do you have concerns? Do you have questions? Because for them, this was a lot of it was new, right? Not the family history part necessarily.
Yeah.
But like, what is archaeology? So they're laymen coming in. And what are the possibilities? These are the possibilities. What do you think about these ideas? Or do you have some other ideas, right? So it took, because you want to build relationships and trust with folks. If you're really going to collaborate with people, you have to act on good faith. I'm a stranger to them. And I'm not a local either. I don't belong to their church. We spent time getting to know one another. And Howard being out at the site with Doug and Alex really helped quite a bit as well. Because not only is he learning the process of archaeology and what kinds of questions can be asked of that record, but he's also getting to know folks who are out there doing the archaeology for StanTech as well. And so it just grew organically. I didn't have a plan. This is how I'm going to become friends with folks or anything like that. But just trying to like work out, hey, showing that I mean what I say, that I'm going to follow through with things that I say that I'm going to do. And I know Alex will work in the same kind of way, right? And so we consulted with just about everything. Hey, I'd like to do a newsletter to keep people, stakeholders abreast of what's going on at the excavations. And Haley and Howard, like, that's a great idea. So, you know, getting various kinds of evidence. Doug helped with that as well, and taking photos and distributing it. And Haley helped to just kind of hand them out to her family members. Who are some people that you think would be interested in this project? You know, can we start a list of people beyond the ones that I'd already contacted and reached out to? Sure, here are some other folks that we should try. And then Haley would call some people, and Howard would call some people. We split up the labor. And so when it came time, I feel like I should take a breath and stop just in case you have a question, but you can edit out, right?
We can edit. This is actually perfect though, because we are like right at the end of the segment and I have so many questions for you. So many. So we will take a quick break and then I want to ask you more about the different options that were presented and talk about the approach in terms of working together to shape what the excavation looked like. And then I want to talk about the oral history part, because cultural anthropologist. So obviously I want to hear about the oral history part, but we will be right back here in a second. Okay, so we're back and let's just go straight at it. So when you were talking with the community members and you were having those Zoom calls during COVID, during the height of COVID, I should say, what you mentioned that you would lay out, like there's this option. What were some of the different areas that you guys discussed and what was the community's feelings about those different options?
Okay, so let's break it down. When I say descendant community, obviously I'm talking about lineal descendants, but I'm also talking about non-lineal descendants. I'm thinking more broadly about people who have heritage ties to a site. And my interface is mainly with the lineal descendants. So Clark and Wright. Because that were Bolivar stakeholders that I'm calling the descendant community that we ended up working with, were family and friends. They all knew one another. Let's just put it that way. All of them, I should say, because there were people like Anthony DeFries, who was a student at University of North Texas, ended up getting a job at the site. He was an undergraduate interested in archaeology. There was a professor in the anthropology department who also was a Bolivar stakeholder. Kelly Kring was a stakeholder as well. I ended up talking to him. Willie Hudspeth was a local activist. He was another person that I leaned into to get from. But a lot of this was all being guided talking to Wright and Clark. Hey, what do y'all think about this? What do you think about that? What kinds of questions should we ask? Who should we do outreach with? And so forth. So on one level, when I was talking to them, for example, about the archaeology, right? So they're new to archaeology, and it's still, we're not really sure what kinds of questions can be asked. So what kinds of questions do we have time for? So I don't know that the archaeology would be able to address them. I don't know if there'd be anything else in the archives about them, but what kinds of questions do you have about your great grandfather. What kind of a blacksmith was he? Funny enough, it turned out to be some of the same questions that we had as well as researchers. How did he, for example, get the experience and the enterprise, the finances to become a landowner, to own a blacksmith shop, right? They had the kinds of questions, like I said, that were shared among all of us. And so that was pretty neat to see. But so there was that kind of engagement and asking of what are your concerns. There were also like, okay, with this project more broadly, what would you like to see done with this history? This is
a
big project and these are big ideas sort of things. So they're like, what other kinds of things have you worked on? So the possibilities are, for example, doing some kind of a website. A digital incentive to reach different kinds of school children and other folks and so forth. How about historical marker? Me, Clark, and Wright worked together on a list of deliverables that we wanted to present as public outreach initiatives to TxDOT that TxDOT would fund. So we came up with a short list of about four or five things, me and the descendants. And then what we did was the three of us split up the labor and started making phone calls to other stakeholders and saying, hey, what do you think about these ideas? What do you think are the pros and cons? How strongly do you feel about that? Do you have any other ideas besides the ones that we've got? And one of the things that, for example, that came up was that some of the stakeholders were like, an interpretive sign, a historical marker is great. We want one that is just for the Tom Cook blacksmith shop. It's like, because they didn't want that history to be obscure, but that was owned by the prominent white citizen, Jesse Thorne.
That everybody already knew.
The whole thing, then it's like, how's Tom Cook's visibility going to be, right? And so the stakeholders certainly did have, and I think it was also great that because oftentimes it was family member talking to family member, they weren't afraid to
be
transparent.
Yeah.
Other folks, they might have been a little bit more, diplomatic or subtle or whatever. Like, oh no, tell them this is what needs to happen. It was great in that sense because you really got to, so that's what we did. We basically got back together. Okay, who'd you talk to? Oh yeah, what do they think? So we came together with a list of public outreach initiatives that we then presented to TxDOT to see if they would support any of these long-term efforts. But the oral history program came out of that as well. Because when TxDOT, before I got involved with the project, TxDOT had a large stakeholders meeting. It was virtual, so there were people across the state that were present at that stakeholders meeting. And this is, of course, before they were breaking ground at the site. And it was suggested at that stakeholders meeting that an oral history program with African-American descendants would be a great idea. So that was one of the things that we presented to stakeholders as well. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. People volunteered to be interviewed or said, yeah, we support this. So that's how the Oral History Project also got put forward as one of the things that we want to see done.
Let's start with the Oral History Project then. So you, during this, we'll call it a survey, you already had people saying, we want to volunteer for this oral history project, which, wow, that is the easiest recruitment method ever. And so I imagine you got a lot of people through that. Were you also recruiting people beyond the people that volunteered in that group? And how did you shape your oral history questions?
Yeah, so this is the thing, right? So it was definitely not, we were trying to do like a representative sample of something, right? I was working with the descendants and saying, who do you think would be important to talk to, right? So we ended up interviewing, we had a list of nine, but one person got very sick. It was really unfortunate that we could not interview them, but we ended up interviewing eight, including her son. And so there were five lineal descendants and three others that we ended up interviewing. All except for one were native to Denton, the city. Of the other person that was not had been living there since 1962, so it was a native.
Wow.
It's Mrs. Alma Clark, who I know Betty Kimball will mention in her interview. But in any case, we interviewed those eight individuals. And it was a process. I had done an oral history project before for the Williams Farmstead, as I mentioned. But Haley and Howard had not. And then I brought my PhD student, Tara Skipton, onto the plow. So there were the four of us working on this oral history project. So it's like, okay, I'm the only one with any experience, so what should we do? So we, Ike, who is the director of the oral history program at University of North Texas, I'd already been in conversations with them about archiving the oral histories there because they've got a great oral history program. It's right there in Denton. And that was one of the things also that came out of, what should we be doing? We want to keep all the resources local. Can the artifacts be curated in Denton? Can the oral history, anything that comes out of this park, can we keep it here? I had already known him because I had taken an oral history workshop with him. I was like, hey, we got this project. Would you be willing to host, train us for a day on methods? And so that's what we did. We did a mini workshop on oral history methodology, and it was Zoom. And then we met weekly to talk about, okay, what should be the themes? What kinds of questions can we ask? So it was a very collaborative endeavor all along the way from the beginning to and from the sort of, should we even be doing this? Okay. Doing this, who should we involve? All right. What's the process? What kinds of questions? What things? All of that stuff was done in partnership, all four of us working together through these things. And so when it came time to do, including where are we going to interview folks? Because at first, it was COVID. So we thought, oh, this is not ever going to take place. I was trying to figure out how to do interviews on Zoom, right? Because we're going to be in person. But we ended up, by the time it came to fruition, was the summer of 2022. So me and Tara were able to actually travel up to Denton, and we did everything in person. And Haley and Howard and Betty were interviewed, but Haley and Howard, because they had some training, also served as interviewers. And it was, yeah, it was a wonderful process. We got about 22 hours of audio from those eight individuals that we interviewed, had them transcribed and archived now with the University of North Texas. The report's not coming out. And Haley and Howard have been involved with, okay, this is what should go in the report. What do you think about this? Is this bio look good? Just pulling up the text in the Zoom call and saying, hey, what do you think? It's, oh, no, that's not when that happened. Change that up. So they've got the draft reports right now. And so we're waiting again for the feedback on it before everything is finalized. Of course, the co-authors on the report as well. It was a really great, for me, I'm speaking for myself, but I'd like to think that they also thought it was mutually beneficial for the Senate community.
Okay, I'm curious, thinking about, okay, this oral history and the archaeology, and were there any moments where one influenced the other, or there's lots of head nodding?
Maybe I'll start, because the archaeologist might, yeah. So my thinking with the oral history project was that that's great if it overlaps with the archaeology, but it doesn't have to, because in itself, minor evidence about the past, that Green Cook family that starts with Tom and Letty, we could trace them back to 1850s, late 1850s, when they enslaved in South Carolina and brought to Tarrant County. It brings that family legacy all the way through the 20th century into the 21st century, because we're interviewing three generations of Cook descendants. My thoughts were, it's great if it enriches the archaeology or overlaps with it, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
And then it was also about getting, as a vehicle for having the descendants, the stakeholders, speak with authority about their own experiences and to emphasize the kinds of knowledge that they wanted to share with the public. You know, which that's how things like questions about the family and community came to that oral history project. It's like, what do you guys want to talk about? You know?
Yeah.
Love of family, the importance of my parents and my church, those kinds of things, right? So that was the primary reasons for doing the oral history. And because it wasn't like with the Branson and Bomster project, that oral history project, we actually interviewed African Americans who grew up in rural farming households. And so asked them about what it was like to milk a cow or to do home canning, keep a kitchen garden, all of these things that Ransom and Sarah are very much based on are doing themselves 50 years earlier. But there was a lot of that. But that wasn't the case with this particular archaeological site and the folks that we were interviewing. But it certainly did give us the opportunity, especially with Mrs. Campbell, to ask her questions about what she remembered about the Cook's offspring, her, including her grandmother, Kitty Cook Clark. We did learn more about the family that way too.
Yeah, and I will reiterate what you just said, which is archaeology and ethnography or cultural anthropology are two separate lines of evidence that are equally important, and that I think it's important that people don't put like one as right or wrong over the other, that they're just two separate lines of evidence.
Yeah. And the other thing I would like to see too with archaeology is not so much using oral history for data mining.
Yeah.
I just want to talk to you because I want you to tell me what you can about the site that I'm doing.
Yeah, what is this artifact?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that it's not like an extractive process, that we go into a community and that's all that we're interested in. So yep. That's...
You got moving out.
I know, right? Yeah.
I love it. I'm like, okay, I guess we have to go back to the archaeology.
Social folks are like, yeah, of course.
Duh.
I should be so hard on
it. I think that one thing just also to add perhaps is what type of archaeology we're practicing and what type of archaeology is possible. We do a community archaeology and collaborative archaeology. So just to continue or to add on to the archaeology that we're practicing is a collaborative and community archaeology. And so one of the ways that through how we're looking at the archaeology and oral histories, it overlapped by our approach of writing a shared history and co-producing knowledge. And so the way that we see it is that the answers aren't always just in the dirt. We got to talk to people. And so it's not necessarily lining them up necessarily, but it's how we can broaden and add a richer texture and tell the whole story, as Howard would say. And so we were able to do that, and as Maria said, by building trust, co-laboring together. And so what's allowed us to do, and with Texas Department of Transportation support, is that we're able to show what types of archaeology are possible. And we have many types of toolkits that are accessible to us, so that folks can bring in oral history and ethnography and archaeology and have that practice by sharing history and bringing in multiple stakeholders and realizing that's not our history to hold, but how we can broaden that and engage with many different stakeholders to co-produce knowledge and understand that approach that we're framing it into what archaeology is possible.
Yeah, and I think both aspects bring a different power. Like, obviously, oral history and ethnography, you're literally amplifying somebody's voice. There's a special element to that. But then archaeology, there's something really special about showing somebody an artifact that is their great grandfather's. There's just something that can't be matched in that. Just like seeing a physical, like tangible piece of proof of your heritage. So I think they both really bring their own special thing to the table. And I'd really love to see more of these projects. The two are working together and complementing each other. I think it just really makes both sides so much deeper. And on that note, we are going to take a quick break. Okay, so we're back. And I know Maria is going to have to go in the not too distant future. We went over our time. And so I want to make sure that if there's anything before you head out that you wanted to speak to that you haven't gotten to speak to yet about this project, I wanted to give you a moment to do that.
Yeah, thank you. I really want to make sure that we give as much credit as that we recognize the amount of contributions that Betty Kimball, Haley Wright, and Howard Clark have given to the project. I heard you asking them about what kinds of things that they were doing with public education. They could have gone on for a bit, and they just really gave us very modest replies. For example, we showed up at Juneteenth at the Fred Moore Park in the city of Denton. They have a very big one every year that's talked about oral histories. This is where the African-American community comes together to celebrate. And Harold was out there blacksmithing the whole day.
It
was
that's so cool.
Out there. Betty Kimball came by to talk and see the displays and to talk to people. It was really great. Yesterday, we were at the Bob Bullock State History Museum giving a panel. Howard and his wife Dawn were there, and so was Miss Betty Kimball. When we talk about public outreach and education, they're part of that process. And for us, especially as an academic, it's like for me to give a paper, it's part of my job. And so, granted, this is their family history, but this takes a lot of time for them too, especially New Orleans. Howard Clark came out to the Society for Historical Archaeology Conference.
Wow.
Yes, in New Orleans in January, and was part of the panel that included us sitting here in TxDOT, staff that are involved with the project, and Howard was there as well. Of course, the audience didn't want to hear from the rest of us, right? They wanted to hear from Howard. And Don, to have traveled all that way, again, that is part of his family legacy, but he has given so much, right? They've all above and beyond. And so I just want to recognize that those public education outreach endeavors, we're not talking about, it's the archaeologist doing this with the descendants. It's now the Cook descendants are actually part of presenting to the public and to academics the research on their family and what they know about the family, right? Their own areas of expertise about that history as well.
Yeah, so spoiler alert, next month's guests are Ms. Betty Kimball and Mr. Howard Clark. It's so worth it, as you already heard. Definitely excited for y'all to share. And I just want to point out, because I don't think she actually said it in the next episode, but Ms. Kimball is 95, right? 95?
93.
So yeah. She was like, I retired 5 years ago. And I was like, so you were 88?
I don't know if you caught that she was talking about a mural that she's like, face painted. Go into driving to Southeast Denton, which is the historically black part of the city, which the Cooks helped to found, by the way. The Cooks, right? There is this big mural, and two of the interviewees, the two of the stakeholders that we interviewed for the Oral History Project and worked with are Alma Clark and Betty Kimball. Their faces are painted as you're driving into. And then they also there's also a art installation that's recent that was put up a couple of years ago by an artist. And it is commemorating the Women's Interracial Fellowship.
Yes.
Of which Alma Clark and Betty Kimball were also a part of. And so they are the service to the community here. You've got the story about her work as a civil rights activist, but we're talking about, you have to remember that you're talking about black matriarchs who were also played important roles in their churches, raising families, working full-time, a lot of them, most of them, because they had to, and really caring for their communities. If there was an event going on, you could ask anybody, Betty Kimball has probably got something to do with it. Faster to do something for this event. Oh, it's at the Martin Luther King Center? Oh, yeah. It is why. It's interesting because her grandnephew, Andrew, who was also one of our stakeholders, mentions in his oral history interview, it's probably that legacy of family members doing service is probably why he ended up being a fireman and why his father was in 30 years of law enforcement. It's just, and Haley is a middle school teacher.
And her husband's finishing firefighter school.
Exactly. So it's, you can go, that's 150 years of that. It's really pretty incredible.
You just gave the best ad for the next episode that I think there could have been. So I appreciate that. Have you be our spokesperson.
I just know that they're very modest people and they're not likely to go on and on about just how much they've contributed to their communities.
And in the field, we can't understate how much Howard contributed as a member of our outreach. Just having him there changed the way all of us looked at and felt about the archaeology and the work we were doing. It just, having him there was amazing.
And beyond just the landscaping assistance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he sounds like he just caught out a weed whacker and just cleared some vegetation out, which would have been a big deal. If you're an archaeologist, that's usually the worst part of the job. But it's why people also came by the site, why we got other African Americans to come out to the site, because Bolivar is not exactly down the street from the city of Denton, right? You have to drive 20, 30 minutes, but it's still, it's out of the way. It's not on the way to ATV or the grocery store or something like that. But if I would just say, because everybody I talk to, hey, please go see the site. It's like, oh, Howard Clark is out there digging at the site. Oh, okay. This is his ancestor. The site himself, because everybody knows the family. It's like, he knows who they are. So it helped to get folks who might not even know what archaeology is, be very familiar with it.
And I will also throw in that I've never felt safer on an archaeological site as having a 30-year veteran
police officer.
When a shady character drove by, he would say, oh, I know where they're going. They're going to do a drug deal just down the road.
Yeah. You don't have to do it on everybody.
Yeah. Everybody.
But he's also, but you don't really have to worry about them.
And there's an aspect where the work we do, it can be very serious and hard work, but there's also a joy brought to it. And it was just so rewarding to be involved with it and to work together. And again, to build that trust and those relationships that we have. And so it went across the team. We're able to show what is possible in terms of the way we manage the project and how everybody participated, and then our interface with the public. And so there's just this aspect where people were just had that aspect of joy and of appreciation because it wasn't some abstract history. We were working together with the descendant community who just brought a great attitude and knew the local landscape of people, the social landscape. And we were able to see how we can broaden that story together to tell a much richer whole story of the past and the present.
And Howard and Alex would sometimes just get on a roll and feed off of each other and laughing. And once or twice I had to threaten to put them in timeout.
There's one thing I definitely want to mention too that is part of the oral history record for this project is that our first interview with Howard was filled with so many place names, and I'm thinking to myself, there's no map that's got places that are no longer there that were there in the 60s, 70s, 80s. So me and Tara Skipton took Howard on this driving tour of Southeast Denton. And so we started in the South, and then we're driving around, and his memory for stuff. Boy, talk about, he can remember the juke joint and Tommy's barbecue and the Washateria. He said on the gas station, and he'd be yelling at the keys because they'd be bothering him, and but you could get gas for 10 cents a gallon at the time. And this is where you get the sweet white cafe, where you get a greasy hamburger. He was just this like very rich kind of tapestry that he wove, that blended like his memories with placemaking practices. And sure, as an ethnographer, you can appreciate that as well, right? That it's just, and as an archaeologist, I'm like, that's not even on a map anymore, right? So those places are not there, but where he used to ride a horse as a kid, that you got a sense of how this landscape has really become very urbanized and gentrified over time. Also, comes through in that tour. So he's really a scholar. It's a piece of scholarship that is really needs to be recognized as such. Not about theory emanating from outside of the ivory tower, but folks, ordinary folks theorize their lives all the damn time, and we don't recognize
And it wasn't just a tour. It was an oral history interview while they were
doing absolutely.
That it's fully recorded, transcribed, and then Tara put together.
And that's the GIS. So there's
oral
history part that has. And funny enough, the other oral history, will mention a place. It's not on a contemporary map, but it's on Athens map. So it serves as a mnemonic device, an interpretive device for the other oral histories as well. So it's, when you work with communities, when you work with descendants, it's like they've got so much knowledge and experience, and they have such an investment in histories. They're wonderful stewards of the past, of their past already. The kind of heirlooming that they do, the way that they curate their past through photos and so forth, it's, they're kindred souls for people like myself who are interested in the past, who are archaeologists, and it's great to be able to work on a project like this where we can engage with them.
Now I'm like, oh my God, I just want to get out in the field and do an interview right now. We'll do an exchange program. You'll come to Colorado, I'll go to Texas.
Absolutely. Yeah, states are close by.
Yeah, we definitely get a lot of Texans in our mountains.
You can't come snow ski Texas. There's no good snow skiing. I'm sorry.
Alas.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we get a little bit more about the archaeology, because we all already know that I could talk about oral history and ethnography all day long. But I also am really interested in hearing more about the archaeology and what you learned through the excavation about the place, about the family, about whatever you want to speak to.
Okay. Alex has done most of the artifact analysis, and he worked very closely with Kelly Kring, who is a professional blacksmith with many years of experience, owns his own blacksmithing business. He teaches blacksmithing. He does blacksmithing reenacting, and he came and visited the site, taught us so much, and we hired him as a consultant to help with the artifact analysis. So I'll let Alex speak to that, but I want to back up just a minute and mention that we also have a team of historians. Amy Dace, Brandy Black, and Alana Vidmar doing the history for Bolivar, the town, for the Sarton Hotel, and the Tom Cook Blacksmith Shop, and always feeding us the information. We didn't have all of it when we were in the field, but we had enough to start understanding things. And their work, along with the oral history and the archaeology, really, they're just so interrelated, and it makes it so much richer. So I do want to acknowledge them. Archaeologically, we had a big surprise in that when we started, it was just a grass-covered area. You couldn't find a single artifact on the ground surface. It was a lawn with a house nearby, and a well-manicured lawn at that. But when we started excavating, we very quickly found one thing that told us, yes, this is a blacksmith shop. We had read about hammer scale, and we took magnets into the field. And hammer scale is when a blacksmith hammers hot iron on an anvil, and every spark is a piece of metal. And so these are the tiniest artifacts that enter the archaeological record. So on the dirt floor of a blacksmith shop, it has literally hundreds of pounds of hammer scale integrated into the sediment. And we were using our magnets and very quickly recognized that, yes, there's places where this hammer scale is concentrated. This is in the blacksmith shop. Here, there's none. This is outside. So that helped us out a lot. But then we ran into what we called the rock pile. We started running into limestone rocks. We just kept expanding our excavation. It got bigger and bigger, and it started going deeper. And very quickly, we found a rock wall adjacent to this rock pile. So this rock rubble, we figured out this had been a half dugout with the walls being stacked rock. And at some point when the dugout was abandoned, they pushed the rock walls in and just collapsed it on itself, and it created that rock pile. And then below that, we had the floor zone of the dugout with occupational debris. So somebody had lived in there for a little while. We surmised that it was Tom Cook and Lathia and their family for some years, but we don't know how many. And they also owned other property. They were landowners besides the blacksmith shop. But the archival record then informed us about that structure, that dugout, because it shows up consistently in several deed records being called a storehouse. So it was. And if you think about it, the dugout is a good way to store items, especially perishable items. If you've got food items that need to be kept cooler, then you have a below-ground dugout. And that's where people do root cellars and things like that. So we were constantly using Maria's oral history information and the archival information and integrating it with our archaeological ideas and interpretations. It was just so much fun to be there and to see all of these artifacts coming out and to watch Howard and his reaction to things. And Howard was a farm kid. He grew up with horses. So even though he says he didn't know much about archaeology, he knows a lot about historic artifacts and what they were used for. And he contributed in so many ways to what we were doing. And Alex can tell you a little bit about what all we learned about Tom Cook as a blacksmith.
Yeah, again, to emphasize the collaborative nature of this work with our great team of historians, the community outreach, oral history, the stakeholder community, descendant community, and then with the, our consulting blacksmith, Kelly Kring. Collaboration is woven into the fabric of this research design. And so in that sense, that all the way through the project, we're engaging with stakeholders because we recognize that we don't have all the answers, and it's not necessarily our history to hold. And so we are very much dedicated to having this collaborative relationship and work with a range of folks. For example, we weren't quite familiar with blacksmithing. And one of the challenges is that we came across, and I think the challenge for archaeologists is that what is the archaeological signature of a blacksmith shop? It doesn't have features the same way that the hotel across the street did. It was a different feature than the dugout. Blacksmith shops are usually, they don't have wood floors. They're actually dirt floors because you'd catch it on fire with,
with
the boards and everything. So you have a wooden structure. It might not even be embedded into the ground. It might just be posts. You want it dark because then you can see the heat. You can see the red. You can see the fire. And then so the challenge that folks face is, what is the signature of the archaeology of blacksmithing? And as we talked about it, it's more than a pile of iron scrap. It's being able to identify, what is this iron? Is this the process of craft work, blacksmithing? And especially with this blacksmith shop during the late 19th century, it's at the intersection of craft and industry. So we're seeing pieces that are mass produced, that are available in Sears Roebuck catalogs of the late 19th century, turn of the century. But then we're also seeing hand-forged, modified materials. And so what we learned working with Kelly, who came out there and was able to help us understand and see, that's hand-forged, modified. And one example then, and so as a blacksmith on the rural industrial frontier, along the Chisholm Trail, Tom Cook would have been involved as a farrier, so working with horses across the range, shoeing horses, fixing whatever you need on saddle wear, what have you. And then also with agricultural equipment, wagon hardware, and then domestic and miscellaneous hardware for just households. So it had all of the different things. He might not necessarily have been what we call a wheelwright, just would have been making wheels, and that's another specific type of trade of blacksmithing. But he was fixing wagon wheels, helping out with a whole range of things. And so we were looking at tools and refuse and all these different things. And working with Kelly Kring, he helped us identify and use the terminology from blacksmithing. So that's another thing that we're doing, is we're bridging between archaeology and blacksmithing. As the anthropologist Marshall Solins would say, is, how can you understand looking at the world through a blacksmith's point of view, that native point of view, and seeing that, and how are we looking at that? So that example is, then we use the term drops. And drops is a blacksmithing term. And so drops are the refuse that fall to the ground. They're cut from hot cuts and chisel work, just broken, and they fall to the ground, and they're called just drops. And that's mainly the types of artifacts that we would find. Because it's also similar to any sort of craft work, whether it's lithic, chert, craft work, the finished products are carried elsewhere. They're carried off. They're put to use. And so you see the refuse around the ground. And we saw that with the metal work. So we see the drops. But the drops also tell us the fingerprint and the signature work of a blacksmith. And so they might be quote-unquote fails, but they might just be left to then be repurposed later. And so we see repurposed files. We see repurposed wagon tire rims. And all of this was through our collaboration with Kelly Crane, helping us understand these different tools and products of the blacksmithing work that Tom Cook was doing, and blacksmith in that context we've been doing. We have over 10,000 artifacts, just metal pieces. Over 25,000 artifacts are from the Tom Cook blacksmith shop. 35,000 artifacts across both sites. And so they tell really different contexts and different stories, but the challenge is, how do you identify the signature of the blacksmith shop? And so through the hammer scale and the magnets testing that, and systematically documenting the soil samples and recognizing that this is a different signature and archaeological assemblage. And so how our goal is to make this a tool and an available and a way of reference for other folks to be able to identify these sites, and as well as the collaborative dynamics of this. And so our archaeological approach is, and anthropological approach is, what more can we do? And one of the things that, you know, working with the Texas Department of Transportation, we've been, it's been a wonderful relationship because we're still here to move the project along, help them facilitate building this road to meet the necessary regulations and to mitigate impact. But at the same time, we're able to show that this is a history that, and the history is on every street corner in a way. And recognize that. And what we see in the public, what we're seeing is people are hungry for history. And we're here to facilitate that and make that accessible. And because everybody's interested in blacksmithing. And Wood is through piquing curiosity and showing we don't have all the answers. Let's go on this journey together. And how can we rediscover the past? Because one thing to mention is the town site of Bolivar was located right on top of the Tom Cook site. And it makes no mention of Tom Cook. And so it does exemplify the erasure and the marginalization of history. And so the history, that is important, because as we'll hear from Howard and Miss Kimball, is Tom Cook is part of a great American story. They are foundational to building the world that we live in. And we all benefit from learning and hearing more from everyone. Kelly Crane, Blacksmith, all folks in the community are excited to be a part of this because we call people in because we don't know all the answers and we're here to learn together. And I never would have thought that I'd become a bit more knowledgeable about blacksmithing. And we
have you tried it?
It's on my to-do list. I let Howard tell me about his wonderful experiences.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, After hearing all this, I feel like I would be the first one to sign up for, what is his name, Chris's classes?
Yeah. Kelly's.
Kelly's.
Welcome you. Yes.
Yes.
He's up in
a little far.
Otherwise, I would have signed up already. He's up by Denton.
Exactly. Wait, did Mr. Clark, was he blacksmithing as a before this project or as a result of this project? Or
so what is absolutely fascinating is that he knew the name Tom Cook if we got in contact with him, but he did not know that Tom Cook was a blacksmith. Dentally, he had started a few years before, probably when he was retiring. He retired about 2017 maybe. But he started forging knife blades.
Yeah, not forging, he was grinding. So this is another thing, he was working on being a bladesmith and grinding. And this is the thing that was, it was really revealing. And we actually carried out interviews with Howard as well on steps in Quakertown House about how he contrasted what he was doing with forging. And in the sense that grinding removes the metal. And so it's peeling back, but forging, you can shape metal. As Kelly and Howard says, forging and blacksmithing move steel. And so he was like, and as Kelly would say, is you forge ugly, and then you grind pretty. And so you just get it to where it's like in the shape, and then you just grind it to then finish it off. And Howard was just doing the grinding of blades and stuff. And so it's really, I think, really affirmed and helped carry him beyond just really me being from just toying with blades to then really being able to move metal. And that's why blacksmiths across world history are seen with great power. Because there is this power and capacity to be able to transform something and to do that. And so there is this whole process to it. And so that's something that I learned this talking with Howard through his experience and sharing that with us.
And a follow up on the idea of blacksmithing being powerful. Tom Cook is not an anomaly as an African-American blacksmith in Texas. This is the first site of an African-American blacksmith in Texas that has ever been excavated, but there are a lot of sites out there. There were a lot of African-American blacksmiths. Most of them came through the plantation system, learned their blacksmithing skills that way, but then upon emancipation, they were able to take those skills and instantly establish businesses or go to work for somebody and start earning money and then buying their own businesses, buying land. So it gave them a leg up. And the one pattern that we see over and over again when we research and look at other African-American blacksmiths historically in Texas is that they were the movers and shakers. They were the leaders in their communities. And there's lots and lots of people out there. And I've started pulling together a database and have 80 names of individuals. Some are very well known and others are like Tom Cook. We just have a name. But when we start researching them, they all fit this pattern. But one example is Joshua Houston. Joshua is famous because he was enslaved by Sam Houston and Martha Houston. Sam Houston was the Republic of Texas, the governor of Texas. So his association with a very famous white man, that was why he's so famous. But he is very similar to Tom Cook in that he was a successful black community leader after emancipation. And the big story here is that this Tom Cook in Bolivar, Texas, is it's just a first step in this road to uncovering a bigger story of African-American blacksmiths in Texas and across the South. This pattern, everywhere I see it, it's very strong.
Yeah. Okay. I wish I had another hour with you guys. This is just how this day is going. But thank you so much for sharing, for doing this work. It sounds like you had the trifecta of historical archive research, archaeology, oral history, and public outreach. So
yeah,
not a trifecta. What do you call it for?
Quadrifecta.
But yeah, so I also want to give a shout out. StanTech did a beautiful video about this project. It's available on their website. We'll put it in the show notes, but it's called, it looks like A Road Connects a Family's History. And it's really super good. It's super well done. I was getting choked up just watching it. And so highly recommend. Also, obviously, everyone come back next month for the follow-up episode with Ms. Betty Kimball and Mr. Howard Clark. It's definitely not to be missed. And the two together are just so good. So thank you again. And excited to hear what future projects you all have in store sometime. So
thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.